case of the day. Dijon v. Holder will be taken on the briefs. The court will proceed to the fifth case, Reliable Money Order v. McKnight Sales. Mr. Samore.
Good morning, Your Honor. Eric Samore on behalf of McKnight. We are here this morning because the magistrate applied the wrong legal standard to the facts. The magistrate found that Klaus Counsel had made a promise to keep a third party's electronic data confidential and further found that counsel had breached that promise. The undisputed facts demonstrate that counsel breached their promise by mining the data for purposes of sending gazillions of solicitations and for filing this lawsuit and more than 100 others. Counsel also intentionally destroyed the evidence of where the solicitations were sent in violation of the professional responsibility laws of Wisconsin and other states. Even the terms of the solicitation were misleading. Despite the magistrate's expressed disapproval of counsel's conduct, he nevertheless certified the class. This order should be reversed. The magistrate applied the wrong standard. He drew a distinction between misconduct directed to the class and misconduct directed to third parties. The magistrate limited its analysis to whether the counsel's misconduct was directed to the class. This was a violation of Montessori and others. Montessori established a legal standard which rejected inviting unethical conduct, whether that conduct was directed to the class or to third parties. Montessori saw the connection between counsel's misconduct to third parties and whether they would serve as loyal fiduciaries. It held that certification should be denied if class counsel has committed a major ethical violation. In effect, the magistrate applied a more lenient standard than even the most egregious misconduct standard rejected in Montessori. It is especially critical to deny certification here, where counsel stands to be unjustly enriched by their own misconduct. Unless certification is denied, misconduct will be encouraged and promoted to the tune of millions of dollars. This case is distinct from many others where counsel stands to gain nothing by the misconduct. The disqualification of one or two firms will not deter this type of misconduct from taking place in the future because these firms are joined as a joint venture, and disqualification of one or two firms will not have any net effect on the financial recovery for the joint venture. The three firms have jointly filed a lawsuit on a contingent fee basis, which is recognized as a joint venture in the In re Johnson case by the Illinois Supreme Court. Bach and Wants have filed more than 100 other lawsuits based on the information obtained from the breach of promise.
Is there any evidence or basis to think that the other law firms had any participation or involvement in the alleged misconduct?
On this record, all we have is that they are united in defending each other's conduct, united in trying to protect each other's reputations, but there's nothing in the record that specifically shows that the other firms were involved in the wrongdoing.
So why aren't they adequate counsel? Why shouldn't the case go on with?
Okay.
Why couldn't we just disqualify the one firm that was involved if we were inclined to do that? But why would that necessarily mean that the class action should be invalidated based on adequacy of counsel?
Right. That's an excellent question. And the reason is because they're a joint venture. Taking the profit from one firm and disqualifying that would result in increased profits to the other members of the joint venture.
So any other firm that came in would be equally disqualified?
Yes.
So no one could ever represent this class?
In our view, that is true.
Why would they be disqualified if they had no participation or involvement in the conduct?
Because they're part of a joint venture. where they are united.
Look, to be a part of a conspiracy, you've got to affirmatively acknowledge the conspiracy and join it. Okay. What evidence is there that the other counsel, you know, promoted this conduct in any way?
Or that they were working together at the time.
Okay. Well, I mean, what we, on this record, I'm saying on this record, there's nothing. I mean, there's testimony.
Isn't that what we have to go on in this case?
Absolutely. So I'll confine my comments to this record. The problem is that there's no net consequence to the joint venture. I mean, these firms, as Wanza and Bach, have filed more than 100 lawsuits based on the breach of on this conduct. They were working together. They filed hundreds of cases even before that. They're more partners than I'm a partner with. I see my partners less than they see each other.
So I guess what you're saying is anyone who touches this data that was received from Abraham is tainted by the way that it was obtained.
I think that's true. I think the fruit of the poisonous tree analogy definitely applies here, and that the only remedy that will prevent...
So all of these fax blasters walk free because the data was improperly obtained?
No. That's not at all. All of the claimants will have all of their substantive rights to file their actions. The class action device is merely a procedural remedy, and that's beyond dispute. We cite the United States Supreme Court. It does not affect in any way, in no way, the substantive rights of the class. Each member of the class will have the right to file suit to collect $500, even though they may have suffered no injury or only a few pennies.
If they nuclear remedy, do we get this out of Rule 23A? Where do we get the authority? Where does the court get the authority to wipe this out?
The authority comes from Rule 23G, where they recognize the key critical role of class counsel in class actions, that they're in many ways the real party in dispute. And what's key here is that they're going to be unjustly enriched to the tune of millions of dollars. If this court affirms and certification goes forward, the message to counsel will be you can reap millions of dollars by your misconduct. And that's going to encourage and promote misconduct.
Let's go to that issue. I mean, Ashford Gear went back down on remand to Judge Gettleman, who conducted a significant further hearing about the alleged misconduct, and he concluded, in fact, there was no misconduct. There had been no promise made. There had been no production made based on a promise of confidentiality. Are we supposed to ignore that fact?
Judge Gettleman is on both sides. I mean, he at one point agrees with the opinion in McKnight saying that there was a breach of promise, and then on the other hand, he says that there was no breach of promise.
After he conducted a further evidentiary hearing,
okay.
Right?
But there was no further other. This is the first oral argument we've had in any case to present our side. The rule upon was the briefs. There's no mention in Judge Gettleman of the undisputed facts that contradict his finding that there was no breach of promise. The magistrate's finding here is much more accurate and consistent with the undisputed evidence. Judge Gettleman makes no reference to the January 5, 2009 email between counsel and Abrams in which she agrees to allow her son to bring the disc to the deposition. Okay. The counsel knew that Abrams was the owner of the business. They knew that she was the only party that had control over the data and that only she could authorize the data. The conclusion that there was no breach here because it was produced by an attorney and her son, neither of whom owned the data, neither of whom controlled the data, was contrary to the undisputed evidence. And I'm astounded.
Did you have no opportunity to present those points to Judge Gettleman on remand in Ashford Gear?
We made the record. We absolutely made a record before Judge Gettleman. It was a voluminous record, and I'm not sure why his opinion came out the way it did, but it was contrary to the undisputed evidence, and he makes no reference to it. It's a very, you know, there's no rigorous analysis, there's no detailed factual findings, and it's It's contrary to the magistrate's finding. If you don't have the record here, we have the magistrate's finding here that there was a breach of contract. That's what we have on this case. So I don't think, and in addition, counsel's story keeps shifting. Back in June of 2010, counsel asserted that the promise of confidentiality was long forgotten by the time counsel received the electronic data in January of 2009. In effect, they were claiming that the breach of promise was inadvertent rather than intentional. Before the magistrate, in this case, they argued that the breach of promise was unenforceable because of the illegality, and now they're asserting there was never any agreement and never any understanding. Their position keeps shifting. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal if possible, if Your Honors will let me. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bach.
May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Phil Bach. I'm here from the firm Bach & Hatch. I'm here with my co-counsel, John Piper, from my firm, and also Ryan Kelly from the Anderson & Watson firm. Defendants' only challenge to class certification in this case is the adequacy of the three firms that the court appointed to represent the class. And as the court's already indicated that it's aware of Judge Gettleman's ruling in the Ashford Gear case, he did go through this entire record, and he said that this whole Abraham production story is pure sophistry. And I admit that I had to look up the word because I wasn't really sure what it meant, but it was very poignant because it's a very complicated story, and then we're forced to prove that it's a lie, and that can be difficult. And we take the Ashford Gear allegations very seriously. We've spent the last year defending ourselves, and courts have unanimously sided with us, even the judges who say, I don't like this, it doesn't feel like it's on the up and up, but I agree you will be loyal to the class. 8 federal district courts and several state court judges, since this court's Ashford Gear opinion, have gone through all this very adversarial. The whole battle is about the lawyers. It's not about the merits of the case, because the merits of the case are very strong. And without the facts data, there would be no way to prove the case, because you have these companies.
Well, it's just a very bitter pill to swallow to affirm here. We would condone despicable conduct. It's maybe a step above a burglary. If you'd gotten this data through a burglary, we couldn't condone that.
I hope not, Judge. I mean, what really happened is that this woman had stonewalled. She wasn't producing anything. She said.
But what she produces turns out to be stuff from all kinds of other matters, not just the matter that you're discovery related.
But she didn't produce it. It was produced 2 months later. After this protective order email is sent, and Kelly says, let's talk about it. She says, let's talk about it when you're here. He goes to New York. She doesn't show up. He subpoenas the son. They didn't move to quash the subpoenas or anything. It gets real adversarial. They hire this lawyer, Eric Rubin, who's from Washington, D.C.
He's the guy that got the $5,000 check delivered to him.
He comes up to New York. He defends he had defended this family when the FTC sued them for running the world's largest fake college diploma mill. They were selling fake international driver's licenses. They go out of business for that. Then they start with the junk faxes. He defended them when the state of Indiana sued them about sending junk faxes in violation of their law. So he's a very, experienced lawyer. He knows about a protective order. A couple months later, he produces the hard drive from his office in Washington, D.C. Nobody ever mentions this should be treated as confidential or anything. It's not confidential. It's not protectable. The only thing on there is stuff that proves that these people violated the law. That's it. And so it's not really like a burglary. It's like somebody offered her the protection of a protective order, like private personal information, trade secrets, legitimate things that could be protected by a court order. Those things would be protected, and she didn't care, but she wasn't trying to do that. She wasn't trying to protect anything legitimate. She didn't want to turn over the stuff because she didn't want to get caught or whatever. But ultimately, the lawyer produces it. He produces it after the deposition. The deposition of Joel Abraham, on the record, they say, we're producing this DVD pursuant to the subpoena. Nobody says it's being produced because Carol Abraham has authorized it or something like that. So they produce it on the record, and a month later, he mails Kelly this hard drive. He didn't have to mail him. He could have moved to Quash. He could have done whatever. They could have said it. They couldn't find it. But instead, he mails it to him. Nobody says, don't look at anything else or anything else. And then after that, she brings the whole issue to Judge Kennelly, who looks at it, and he ultimately concluded, you know, she came to him and said, please enter a protective order preventing these guys from using this hard drive, and here's my whole situation. And he said no. He said it's not protectable, and I'm not going to order them not to use it. And he said it doesn't feel like everything's on the up and up or whatever. And, you know, like you're saying, Your Honor, I appreciate that. I mean, we're not conceding there's misconduct, but it's no fun to defend yourself. And it would have been nice if Kelly had sent a letter or an email or something to her that said, all bets are off, we're fighting, you know. But instead he subpoenaed her adult son who, you know, shows up with a lawyer and everything else. It's really not, he didn't send her a letter, an email, and then she said, okay, here's all the stuff. You know, that didn't happen. Nobody ever did that. It was, he had to push. And he was pushing because Judge Kendall had just denied class certification because we couldn't get the list of class members. This is all in our brief. Couldn't prove who got them. So she said, I know something happened, but you can't prove it. He finds this lady by subpoenaing a bank from a check in the case to show who'd been paid. And Miss Abraham basically is laundering the money through to Romania. She says, well, I would receive the checks and deposit them in my bank account, and somebody in Romania would withdraw the money. She said, my son Joel, he doesn't know anything. Once in a while, he helps me with computers. In the record, we've showed he was there the first 6 months setting this all up. These people are very sophisticated. She's a PhD in mathematics. The kid's majoring in physics. I mean, these are smart people. They were not tricked by Ryan Kelly in any way. And there's nothing happened that shows they were tricked. He didn't say something and then something good happened for him. He said things and they would resist. He moved to compel. He got a rule to show cause. She still wouldn't produce it. And so I understand what you're saying, Judge, we don't expect an opinion from this court that says, these guys are great. But the question is, are we loyal to the class? Are we going to push the case for the class? And there's no evidence that we're not going to.
You are really the class.
Well, not really. The class members do care about these things. This plaintiff testified that they didn't know that you could file a lawsuit about these things. People hate junk faxes, but they don't really necessarily know that it's illegal. And when they do know it's illegal, they really don't know how to go to court. You know, some people do, but most people are just frustrated. And you know, as a result of these lawsuits, basically we get the word out to everybody. I can't imagine how many people got these solicitation letters and said and didn't call back or whatever, but said, "Holy cow, these things are illegal. We better never do that."
And you have no list of who the solicitation letters went to.
I believe Anderson and Wants can say who got these solicitation letters. I don't know where this
is. Wasn't that data destroyed?
No, it wasn't. What happened in the Ashford Gear case in front of Magistrate Judge Cole was that they were talking about the letter sent to that Ashford Gear letter. This is a different letter. It's sent at a different time. And, in fact, we produced the letter that the plaintiff got. It's attached to and at the deposition. It was produced like the day before the plaintiff's deposition. And so, you know, and that, you know, Illinois, as far as the ethical rules on the letter, Mr. Wansa's letter complies with the Illinois rules. He does say advertising material on the envelope in the letter. Illinois doesn't require that a lawyer maintain a list of the recipients anymore. Okay? Wisconsin has that requirement that you file the letter with them, and apparently they mailed one of the letters to their version of the ARDC, the regulatory people. But they didn't technically file it. But whether they filed the letter,
well, they mailed it there, thinking that was a potential class member.
Yeah.
Not to comply with the disciplinary requirements.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the smart thing would have been to mail, you know, read the Wisconsin rules and mail it to the Wisconsin regulatory people. But you know, there's a question about whether the Wisconsin rules apply to an Illinois lawyer who doesn't practice in Wisconsin who sends some advertising letters. And, you know, I know that Mr. Seymour is pushing this joint venture thing, but the fact is, all through all this, there is no argument or evidence in the record or outside the record, this whole him saying, well, not in the record, that my firm, that anybody at my firm did this or knew about it or condoned it. We've, you know, we've been addressed with it. When we heard, the first time we heard Carol Abraham making these claims is when she started sending letters to courts at the recommendation of some defense lawyers. You know, send letters to courts and see what the judge will do, that sort of thing. And so we had to go through all these things since 2010. We did it with Judge Connelly. And when we heard those things, we investigated the facts. And hopefully you can tell that I do believe that Ryan Kelly's version of how he got this hard drive is the true one and her version isn't. But our duty is to the class, too. You know, we have a duty as lawyers to do the right and honorable thing. But we also have a duty. The question here is, are we good lawyers for this class? And are we gonna fairly and adequately represent them? And there's no evidence that we won't. In particular, our firm, who had nothing to do with this misconduct, alleged misconduct, except by virtue of doing lots of cases with this other firm. Since, you know, 2003, we've been doing cases about this TCPA. I see my time is up, so thank you.
Mr. Bach, Seymour, do you have any time left? Well, you may have an additional 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Much appreciated. Counsel has a huge stake, and they've been successful in clouding the issues before the district court. Their chronology of event is just out of whack and inconsistent with the actual facts, which show beyond any doubt that there was an understanding. Just by way of, and what they do is they've misstated what actually took place in, from a chronological perspective. December 16, they make a promise of confidentiality in virtue of an email. I think December 28th or so, Ms. Abrams misses the meeting. 2 days later, they request that I keep the fax data confidential. A few days after that, their counsel emails Abrams and asks if the son will bring the disk to the deposition. She responds, yes, I will have my son bring the disk to the deposition. They clearly knew that she was the one that approved the release of the material. They clearly knew that she had not rejected. There's nothing, no statement that she's rejecting their offer of confidentiality or changing her mind, that she doesn't want the information to be disclosed to third parties. In addition, the solicitation.
Why did they have to subpoena her son then?
They had to subpoena her son for his deposition because he had some information relevant to this broadcasting operation. And as a part of the, as part of that, they requested that he bring the backup disk. But he doesn't control that, and because he's not the owner, he's not even an employee of the place. They know that she's the one that is authorizing it, and in fact, she emails him to say that yes, he'll bring the disk. It was actually grossly overreaching for them to be making this request for the entire, because it had contained so much information above and beyond what was relevant in any of the four lawsuits that were pending. I mean, it was a gross overreach. In addition, I will just say that, you know, Wansa has testified that Mr. Bach was aware of the solicitation content. And I think that if you look at the record carefully, at the undisputed emails and their undisputed statements in court, you will see that this case does not turn on Ms. Abrams' credibility, that the case against them is proven by their own conduct, which is beyond dispute. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.